Well, let's see, we beat the attorneys then, I guess we should.
My apologies.
My law clerk's not in yet either.
All right.
What happened here?
I don't know what the deal is.
Would you ask Jennifer or Sarah?
Who's on the other side? We're missing an attorney too.
He's right here.
All right, okay, now we're slowly, who missing? Jennifer? One of the clerks want to go round up the rest of your, group? While we're doing that, Court would like to welcome this morning, students from Bonham High School and, also their teacher, Lawrence Nemiga, and also Mariah Rogers and the first year paralegal students from Western Dakota Bow Tech in, Rapid City. Everybody present on the counter floor now? All right, the, next case is State v. Andrews and, for the appellant, State of South Dakota, we have Mr. Todd Love, an Assistant Attorney General here. And for the appellee, Mr. Andrews, we have Mr. Robert Van Norman, an attorney from Rapid City. Okay, let's see. Mr. Love, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, we're here today asking this court to affirm that what you said in State v. Carlin back in 1999 is, in fact, what the law is. It is our contention that the trial court erred in finding a violation of the 180-day rule in this case. Specifically, it's our contention that the trial court both misread the State v. Carlin and misapplied that case. Specifically, in this case, the trial court, in addressing the 180-day rule issue, made a legal conclusion, specifically conclusion of Law 5 in its findings of fact, where it said that the Carlin case did not address whether the dismissal in this case was done by a competent judicial officer. It's our position that Carlin did in fact address that issue. In State v. Carlin, the facts very closely mirror what happened here in the Andrews case. In Carlin, the defendant was indicted in September of 1996. A few months later, following some motion hearings, the prosecutor gave notice that he intended to dismiss the case and to reindict, which he went and did approximately a week later. The trial court in that case ruled that the 180-day rule was not violated because the 180-day rule started anew with the initial appearance on the second indictment. This court, in addressing that case, applied the two-part test that it had been using for approximately the last 10 years. That two-part test is phrased as the 180-day rule starts anew at the time of the second charging if the initial indictment was properly dismissed by a competent judicial officer, and two, that the record does not reveal evidence of a prosecutorial attempt to circumvent the 180-day rule. This court ruled that both prongs of the test had been satisfied and that the 180-day rule did in fact start anew at the time of the second charging.
But doesn't that conflict with our statute? Our statute says that the 180 days starts to run when the defendant appears before a judicial officer. So if that's true, then are you saying that a prosecutor and a judge are the same thing? That appearing before a prosecutor is enough to start the 180-day rule running?
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor. I think clearly in 23A44.5.1, it does use the phrase the appearance before a judicial officer.
So you're saying the judicial officer means two different things?
I think it means two different things in two different senses. And I think that's the logical reading of the Carlin case. In Carlin, the court specifically noted that the charges were dismissed by the prosecutor. The previous cases did not address that. The Tiedemann and Lowther cases were cases where the initial charging document was dismissed by the court. But in Carlin, this court specifically noted that it was the prosecutor that dismissed that case. I believe the only logical reading of that case is that for the purposes of that rule that was announced in Carlin in the previous cases, that a prosecutor has to be seen as a competent judicial officer under that
rule. You're referring that, but that was that argued in Carlin, though, whether a prosecutor was a competent judicial officer?
I wasn't at the oral argument. I don't know if it was argued from the opinion. I don't know that it was. So, but Carlin is the law that, of course, we rely on when we make the decision as to whether we can dismiss and what effect that might have on the running of the 180-day rule in the event that we come back and recharge at a later date, which is, in fact, exactly what occurred in this case.
So under your theory, if the time doesn't start anew, then you actually, the prosecutor could dismiss any time after the original indictment and could wait 10, 12, 13, 14 years and then recharge again.
Well, I think obviously there's other issues that would come into play in a scenario like that. If you get statute of limitations issues, possible constitutional speedy trial issues.
Okay, let's bring it down to 2 years then.
Yeah. Well, I think theoretically, yes. I mean, there may be other issues that come into play at that point.
But that's totally against the spirit of the 180-day rule, isn't it?
Well, I think that's what the 180-day rule allows. That I don't doubt that there could be other issues that would have to be addressed under those situations, and that there are other statutes, specifically I think the next statute in the book, I believe it's 23A443, that specifically addresses the judge's authority to dismiss a case if there's been an unreasonable delay in charging out a case. So I think there's other remedies at play, but under the speedy trial rules under 23A44.5.1, I think the only logical reading of that and the Carlin case is that for these purposes, a dismissal by the prosecutor under circumstances where, you know, we don't get to the second prong of the case and talk about intentional circumvention of the rule, that the time period under that rule needs to start anew at the time of the second charging. I think that is consistent with the spirit of the dismissal laws. Under 23A44.2, it's the prosecution that is given the authority to dismiss a case essentially at any time up to the time of the trial. It's only after the trial starts that the defendant's permission is needed. There is nothing in the statute or in the case law that addresses the court's intervention in that process, any court permission required to file a dismissal, or any legal standards that would inform our decision, such as good cause standards or anything like that. It's a blanket.
The prosecutor can dismiss, but that doesn't mean there's consequence. There's no consequences to his actions.
I mean,
he has the authority to dismiss. I'll concede that. But that does not mean there's no consequences to his dismissal if he lets the case go on and on and on.
And I don't dispute that. There may be other consequences. And I said when we get into issues of speedy trial, the other statutes at play, the constitutional issues, there may be other remedies and maybe other issues to address. But I think the trial court's finding in this case that this court did not address that, I think the only logical reading of the Carlin case is that this court did rule that for purposes of this test, The prosecution has to be seen as a competent judicial officer exercising its authority under statute to dismiss the case.
But that doesn't make him a competent judicial. I mean, the issue was never really reached and never expressly reached. And so let's just consider that for a minute. How can a person from the executive branch be a competent judicial officer, which implies someone from the judicial branch?
And I can't obviously tell the court here that that was briefed and argued as an issue in that case. I don't know that it was. I think that that myself and any other prosecutor acting as an officer of the court can be seen as acting in that capacity for purposes of this rule. And that's what we're asking this court to affirm, that Carlin does in fact mean what it says. And again, Carlin specifically indicates that it was the prosecution that dismissed the case, and because the rule was met, the second prong of the test was satisfied, that the time started anew. Now, it's our position that even if the court has those misgivings and that it wasn't argued, that it wasn't addressed in the Carlin case, that if the prosecution can't be seen as a competent judicial officer under the strict language of that statute, that the trial court in this case still erred in dismissing this case. What the trial court did in this case, specifically if you look at conclusions of law 2 and 3 in Judge Brown's findings and findings of fact and conclusions of law, essentially what he did is he ruled that at the time that the first indictment was dismissed, even though the prosecution terminated, that the 180-day rule continued to run during the time when no charges were pending and when the case had been dismissed. I believe that that also is, and I don't know that that issue has specifically been addressed with this court, but I believe that that is an error. If we look back to when this court first adopted this rule back in 1988, the Tiedemann case, this court indicated that it was influenced by the Pennsylvania and the Illinois decisions and their approach to this charging dismissal and recharging issue. If you look at the cases that this court specifically cited back in the Tiedemann case, the Davies case out of Pennsylvania and the Sanders case out of Illinois, even those cases specifically address the fact that during the time when after the dismissal had been filed, during that time period between the dismissal and the recharging, that time period is not counted for purposes of the speedy trial rules. There are issues about whether the time period during which the initial indictment was pending counts, and the time period during which the second indictment is pending counts. It's essentially an addition process. They refer to it as tacking and tolling, that we tack together the two time periods, but we don't count the time period during which no charges were pending against the defendant. And I think that makes sense. In this case, for example, there were other issues raised as it relates to the 180-day rule. For example, in this case, the trial court made a finding that during the time that the first indictment was pending, between approximately May 7th of 2007 and August 21, 2007, when the dismissal was filed, that 14 days countable under the 180-day rule had elapsed. Most of that time was excluded due to the filing of defense motions. The trial court, a couple of the other things we addressed with the trial court were, one, after, I believe it was August 1st, 2007, at the motions hearing, when the court actually made a decision, an oral decision on the motions, none of those decisions were ever reduced to writing. Under this court's precedent, that is not a final adjudication of those issues for purposes of the 180-day rule until they are. The trial court in this case ruled that once the dismissal was filed, that the prosecution was terminated, all the previous motions were moot, that had no effect at all. Essentially, the failure to have the court sign off on those motions had no effect. In addition, there was an issue that during the pendency of the first indictment, the defendant waived the 180-day rule. The trial court again found that due to the dismissal, that was moot, and that didn't count anymore. So essentially, the trial court found that the prosecution terminated, all the motions were moot, the legal rulings were not in effect, the waivers were not in effect, but yet the 180-day rule continues to run for purposes of counting time against the state.
Did the trial court use the second prong then to say that the prosecution was trying to evade the 180-day rule?
The trial court did not. The trial court ruled in its findings that because we had not met the first prong, he ruled that we were not a competent judicial officer and it wasn't dismissed by a competent judicial officer. The trial court ruled that it did not have to reach the second prong and declined to do so. I don't believe that impacts this court's ability to examine that at all. The review in this case is a de novo standard. The question under the second prong is whether the record reveals a prosecutorial attempt to circumvent the 180-day rule. Based on the record that's before this court, I don't believe there's any indication that could possibly be the case. The trial court did find that 14 days is what had elapsed. I would say that cases, you know, if we were in a situation, which we do see in some of the other cases, where the prosecution gets up to day 179 or 170 and dismisses, goes and refiles in an attempt to circumvent that rule, that's clearly a case where that's what the prosecution is trying to do. I think even in one of the prior cases, which cited in the defense brief, the Head case, while not completely on point with what we're talking about here today, it did make this court did make that finding, or at least noted that instance where the prosecution was clearly trying to circumvent the 180-day rule, which in that case had actually run. But in this case, 14 days had elapsed under the 180-day rule at the time that the dismissal was filed. There is no indication in the record, and there is no facts to suggest that the purpose of filing a dismissal was for the purpose of evading the effect of the 180-day rule. Essentially, we dismiss and try to get around it, or we're stuck and we're going to get dismissed by the court. That was simply not the case here.
Well, the principal purpose was so that you could use, so that this trial would come second, so the other defendant, essentially a co-defendant, you could use his testimony against Mr. Andrews. But then, I don't think that completely answers the question, because then it still permits you to, you can just delay the trial on, under your theory, you can delay the trial on Mr. Sonnenschein practically forever under the 180-day rule, and then recharge Andrews. All the time he knew he was going to be recharged. He knew he wasn't off the hook. He knew that the purpose of your dismissal was so you could use the testimony against him and he'd be recharged. So it seems to me that you're really extending the 180-day period, because you control when Sonnenschein gets tried. You can get continuances there that maybe show some good cause or something like this, and by the same token can extend this one.
And I don't dispute some of that, Your Honor. I mean, there's no doubt in this case that the reason we did it, the reason we dismissed the Andrews case, was because we wanted to try the Sonnenschein case first, and we wanted to complete that. There's no doubt about that.
So why didn't you try the Sonnenschein case sooner?
No. The decision was made to indict both at the same time.
Okay, but during this time that the 180-day period runs, at least under the non-competent judicial officer theory, why didn't you try Sonnenschein sooner there? From the time you dismissed against Andrews.
I guess the only response I can give to that, Your Honor, is that after the indictment, we went through the, we initially had an affidavit for change of judge, then we went through the motions hearing process, and it was at the August 1st motions hearing when the trial court addressed setting trial dates. And that's the time when we had the opportunity to both know and decide who was getting tried when. So I don't believe that under those circumstances, you know, we necessarily have control. I mean, we don't necessarily have control of what the trial court's calendar is going to be and when they're going to have the ability to try, which a case which in this instance, as we believe, would have been approximately a 2 to 3 week trial.
Well, didn't you ask to, I understood the record that you did ask the court to try the cases in the order you wanted, but the court didn't do it.
That's correct. We did ask the court to try in that order, and the trial court decided otherwise. And that is the reason that we chose to dismiss so that we could try the Sonnenschein case first.
Were you relying on your interpretation of the Carlin case in making that decision?
Absolutely. You know, we did address that before we made the decision to dismiss and tried to determine what effect it might have on the 180-day rule, and Carlin is precisely what we relied on in making that decision.
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Mr. Van Norman, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court. Good morning, Mr. Love. Your Honors, there are a couple of things that I would like to address that Mr. Love said toward the end of his argument. And I really invite you to read the transcripts of the August 1 motions hearing in 2007 before Judge Trandall. And I also invite you to read the transcript of the August 29 hearing that Judge Trandall gave me access to the record on after the dismissal in 2007 by the state. What's remarkable to me about the August 1 transcript in that hearing is that never did the state say anything other than it might be appropriate, or it is, and that's the word that was used, appropriate to try Mr. Sonnenschein first and Mr. Andrews second. There was nary a hint that they were going to dismiss at that time. No statement to the judge, no statement of record in that regard, only that it would be more appropriate. The discussion then took place during that hearing as to trial scheduling, counsel's availability, and that sort of thing. I was given for Mr. Andrews a November date. I said at that time that that would mean that we would waive any objections under the 180-day rule. And by the way, I was not told that that was going to happen. Had I been told that there was a dismissal imminent on the record and the court had been advised, I would not have waived any argument with regard to the 180-day rule. That is why I believe Judge Brown ruled as he did on that topic with regard to whether there had been an effective waiver. I simply did not have that information. It wasn't knowledgeable. With regard to whether or not Mr. Barnett earlier on or Mr. Love along the way indicated that if he didn't get the scheduling he wanted that they might dismiss against Mr. Andrews, that's quite true. During that time, there were plea bargains batted back and forth. Talk about that. Talk about various scheduling issues. None of that is important because it wasn't of record. One of the things, and I don't think this court has to reach this, because I think the crucial issue here is competent judicial authority, and it was properly applied under the precedents. I don't think the court has to reach the second issue under the two-part test. Because But if it does, I think the Lowther decision speaks loud and clear to that. And that is a dismissal under these circumstances is probably the best inferential evidence of the state trying to circumvent the effect of a speedy trial statute. And if you wish to reach that, that's fine. I don't believe that's the function the court has here for purposes of this appeal.
But don't you have to read the issue if the two-pronged test provides the 180-day period commences when the defendant has first appeared on the re-indictment. If, one, the earlier indictment was properly dismissed by a competent judicial officer, and, two, the record does not reveal evidence of a prosecutorial attempt to circumvent the 180-day rule?
No.
Isn't it a two-pronged deal, and it says and, not or?
No, I think the way it is applied properly is that if it isn't a competent judicial authority that dismisses, then that ends the inquiry. I know it says conjunctive the way it's stated, but I looked at the Pennsylvania cases and our earlier cases discussing that. I truly believe it isn't a mandatory joinder of those two parts.
And what case are you relying on for that position?
Tiedemann, I believe, addresses that. The application of the cases is Braithwaite and Brennan in Pennsylvania, I believe, addressed that as well. I recall that Thrapp may as well in Pennsylvania.
They dismissed solely on the prong one?
I can't tell you, Your Honor, that that is exactly what happened. I believe that the inferential reading of those cases is clear that those are separate tests.
Then why didn't it say or?
Well, I think the burden's on the government, of course, to show, as far as I'm concerned, that they haven't improperly applied it. I wish I could tell you that it should say or. I don't think it needs to under these circumstances.
But, you know, if you look at Tiedemann, which you just referred to, it, the Tiedemann court said in that case there was 152 days left of the 180 after the dismissal. And it said it's difficult to envision a surreptitious intent on the state's part to secure the first dismissal of the charges as a means of avoiding the sanctions on the 180-day rule. So if they can't do it with 152 days left, how can we do it with 166 days left?
Well, let me talk about what I think is if the court doesn't dismiss based on prong one, the first of the prong.
Assuming we agree with you that this was not dismissed by a competent judicial officer.
Yes. I haven't had access to the record in the court below on that specific topic. None of the judges has ever had access to Mr. Love, for example, for an exposition of what was the reasoning for this dismissal. What happened was he told Judge Trandall simply that it was appropriate in his mind.
That's all we have to go on anyway. I mean, all we can look at is the record now as it is. Isn't that right?
If you have to reach that.
Right.
I disagree with Mr. Love with regard to the de novo review on that topic
right.
on this appeal.
Right. If we have to reach that, don't yes. we use Tiedemann to tell us that if 152 days is left, is indicia that there is no intent to avoid the 180-day rule? How do we get past the fact that there was 166 days left here?
Well, I think you go on to the count. They waited and waited and waited before they recharged. And well over 250 days expired before they even bothered to recharge. And nothing of significance happened in between, Your Honor.
What about, though, in that respect, the state's argument that even under the Pennsylvania rule, you don't count those 240 days?
That's if you assume that the refiling was preceded by passing both prongs of the test. And my point, and I believe Carlin does not reach this topic, and I believe the earlier case law here in this court, and I don't think we have to go very far afield to reach this conclusion, that you have to have been a competent judicial authority to dismiss in the first instance. And if you weren't, and then you wait, and the total amount of time that passes before refiling exceeds 180 days, you're barred.
What about the tacking and tolling that counsel talked about? If the two-part test is used with tacking and tolling, and there was not a judicial officer who dismissed this, then the time from the time that the initial charge started until it was dismissed is counted against the state. But the time after the dismissal until the new charge is not counted under the tacking and tolling. Don't the Pennsylvania courts use that methodology?
No, I don't believe they do. I think there are other courts that do. Kansas uses tacking and tolling. I do not believe Pennsylvania ever talks about tacking and tolling under those circumstances. It's really more an initial, I think once you choose to indict, then that kicks in the consideration both under Pennsylvania law as well as South Dakota precedent. And that's where it starts, rather than tacking and tolling in between with clear demarcations between initial dismissal and re-indictment. I think it's a huge difference on approach. I think it also, that difference in approach, I really think carries out the purpose of the 180-day rule, which was started in 1985, as I recall. I can remember the congestion in courts then that really was the root cause of the rule and the need to strictly apply it. And that, I think, is, despite what Mr. Love said about relying on Carlin, which does not explicitly address this issue. Despite that, we all take that risk as we practice law. Sometimes we're wrong. And quite frankly, here the state is. I believe this whole application of this rule and what I'm urging and what Judge Brown did protects someone like Mr. Andrews from being manipulated and the trial court schedule being manipulated as it was here. Mr. Love, on behalf of the state, could have in August, we had access to the record in two instances, made a motion for good cause delay. And that's what is anticipated and contemplated specifically by the 180-day rule statute. He did not. He chose not to for whatever reason. And that reason, I submit, inferentially, is another factor on the dilatory practice. And that is, had he had a reason, he would have stated it.
Was your client under any kind of restraint or restriction by the state after the dismissal?
Not directly because of the criminal action. It was gone, obviously. He has collateral consequences as a licensed realtor, and the license was suspended, reinstated, suspended every time there was a criminal action.
But there was no bond pending. There was no... His passport wasn't taken or anything like that. He was able to do everything as a citizen that had no pending criminal charge.
That's absolutely correct.
But his realtor's license was suspended during that period of time?
In between?
Yes.
A portion of that time. It took some time to get it reinstated, obviously, after the dismissal. But it was reinstated for a short period of time, but the practicality of business, whether it's as a practicing lawyer or as a realtor, is that you have clientele that either can or cannot rely on you. And practically, that was a disastrous situation, particularly with the threatened and pending new charges.
Is any of that in the record as far as what the realtor board did in respect to his license?
I know in the August 29 hearing, we discussed that matter. I can't remember if there were specific documents entered, but I know Mr. Love knows, and I know that there were suspensions in between. But I don't believe that or suspensions when there were pending cases, as is the case now. But I don't believe we made further record on that topic. It's not like he was back in jail, but there are cases that recognize the fact of threatening lawsuit. Coming back in is a heavy consequence, you know, and having to get new counsel. I was the same counsel, but hiring counsel again for that purpose and all the hardships associated with that. But as I said to Justice Konenkamp, there weren't other specific problems that we were talking about or consequences.
That's never been put into the record.
You know, I can't recall. Mr. Love may recall specifically on that topic. I know, though, at the last hearing that we had on August 29, that I discussed reinstatement of the real estate license, and I asked what the Attorney General's position would be So by implication that, you know, we're obviously talking about something that was a fact then. But since the rest since then, no, I don't believe that is in the record.
What's your response to the state's argument on 23A44-5 in that Iowa case, State versus Fisher?
I'm trying to remember what Fisher itself was.
That's the one that says that the dismissal, in effect, does not, it's not part of the time, it's not included as a part of the time.
Yes, and my response is it's a choice. I think that the court has to make and has made about the three different approaches that was outlined in that were outlined in Tiedemann with regard to application of the 180-day rule. And I believe we've clearly in this court, in our tradition here over the last 20-some years, chosen to say, hey, you do take a risk, Mr. Prosecutor, if you do certain things. And that is a different approach. I do believe it counts under the right factual circumstance. And that is what we have here. One of the things that Mr. Love talked about in his brief, and I'd like to address it fairly shortly here, and that is whether or not there'll be some damage done to the dismissal statute if the court upholds Judge Brown's decision. And what I'm saying is that, you know, these are not in conflict. And I think Justice Sabers was reaching that issue earlier. The dismissal statute and the 180-day statute can be interpreted to be in harmony. And I think that was the point that the court made at the end of December in the Promising Future case, that you look at the statutes, and even though on the face, if they're applied in a certain way that the state in this instance doesn't like, they could be seen as conflicting. But they're not. The 180-day statute was clearly passed to protect defendants' rights. The early cases out of this court discussed, and I believe it was a concurrence, discussed that, I believe it was Holiday, discussed the purpose. And the purpose is to move cases along, and it's the state's obligation along with the courts to make sure that the cases move along. There's nothing that Mr. Andrews did that delayed this case. The choice made by the state was purely for their own convenience. After they made the dismissal that they did here, they did nothing for many months. And once they even went, settled the Sonnenschein case, they then didn't even use Mr. Sonnenschein for any purpose to reindict Mr. Andrews. And I think that's remarkable. If the rationale really is to wait. And do keep in mind, too, this difference, I think, further difference between Carlin and this case. When the reindictment came out, it was the same case. There's no new evidence, but for one charge that was deleted that had previously been charged. The submission by Mr. Love to the grand jury, and the transcript, I believe, is in the record, was simple. Same grand jury, you've heard everything before, here are the proposed indictments, recall the testimony. And then they indicted. So, you know, if you go to the second prong, I think inferentially we have clearly further evidence that whatever the state was doing wasn't to move this case along. It was quite frankly, for its own convenience, for some reason that is not apparent. And if the reason isn't apparent, and since they didn't take the opportunity to make a motion and explain to the trial court the reasons for good cause delay, which I submit they had none, then obviously on the second prong, if you have to reach that, the state has failed as well.
So if we reach that second prong, we specifically, what would you point to that would imply a intent on the part of the state to circumvent the 180-day rule?
Okay. I think you have to start.
Are you saying it's just a bad smell test here?
No.
Lack of due diligence.
Well, partly, yes. And there are cases that reach the question of diligence as a part of the second prong. The first thing that I think is problematic, and you put it in this context, is that the state chose to indict Mr. Andrews when it did. You know, once you indict someone, that is a very serious matter. So you start with that, and then you move on to, hey, if we don't get the right scheduling informally, we may dismiss, maybe we'll get a plea bargain's offered. That sort of thing goes on, and part of that is not in the record.
Right.
But you get then to August 1, and there is not one mention that there's a good cause delay or that the state is going to dismiss. Not one mention by Mr. Love, simply that it would be more appropriate, he'd prefer it. Well, I'd prefer a lot of things in my practice, and you know, that isn't the way this works out, obviously. After that, at the August 29 hearing, Mr. Love again makes no argument on behalf of the state as to a good reason why this should be dismissed, other than they thought it was more appropriate. After that, they sit on their hands, apparently, for almost 254 days, as I recall, 250-some days. Nothing happens. And as I said a little while ago, they didn't use Mr. Sonnenschein for any purpose, and they reindicted on the same.
Don't we same see charges. That? I mean, it seems to me that in prosecutions, we often see in drug cases, organized crime cases, white collar crime cases, that a bunch of people are charged as being part of a criminal enterprise, and the government wants to try some first and work their way up sometimes to the mm-hmm. to the higher echelons. Why is that not a right? Why is that improper here? If the state decides that it's to their advantage to try one of these men, two of whom are allegedly involved, well, now one's convicted, involved in bribing a public official. Why is that wrong for the state to want to take one case before the other?
It's wrong if you indict them. That starts all kinds of considerations running. If there are speedy trial prejudicial issues under constitutional provisions that pop up later because the government's taken too long, that could be answered in that context. But once they decided to charge my client, all these protections kicked in under the statute. Is it wrong? Initially a Supreme Court decision and a rule, and then a legislative decision, but that can't be allowed.
Thank you, Counselor. Your time
has expired. If I might, too, I wanted to mention that it's my pleasure to have the Western Dakota Tech people here because I'm on their advisory board, so it's a pleasure for that reason,
too. Well, then you can have them critique you later.
Well, I'm fearful of that.
Mr. Love, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Initially, I would take issue with Mr. Van Norman's arguments that procedurally nothing happened after the dismissal and there was nothing going on. As Justice Konenkamp indicated, there was another defendant in this case. During that time period, we proceeded with further motion hearings. We actually got ready for trial. It was literally on the eve of trial of Mr. Sonnenschein that we reached a plea agreement where he agreed to plead guilty to, I believe it was two offenses, to debrief, to testify against Mr. Andrews as required. It was shortly after the Sonnenschein case was finalized that we went back to the grand jury and reissued an indictment against Mr. Andrews. The fact that I chose not to call Mr. Sonnenschein to actually provide testimony at the reindictment is simply a function of the evidence that we had to present to the grand jury. It has nothing to do with the availability of Mr. Sonnenschein to provide that testimony, which in fact he was. there is no doubt here, and we certainly admit that the reason that we did this is to make that procedural choice, not a lot different from the drug cases and the organized crime cases, where we feel it is advantageous to proceed with one case prior to another and build on the cases that we've tried before.
All right, but you indicted both of them at the same time.
We did.
So you do risk the possibility that although you prefer to try one before the other, that the trial court may not agree with you and schedule one over the other. And so I guess it brings me to my concern that counsel mentioned. What about this tacking and tolling rule? Where does that come from, and why should, if we haven't used it, why should we use it?
I can understand the argument that's made in some of the cases about, and I believe it is addressed in at least some of the Pennsylvania cases, and perhaps in Sanders' case out of Illinois too. I'm sorry, I don't recall off the top of my head, about the concern the courts had of simply giving the prosecution a blank slate and say you can wipe out everything that happened before. And I can understand that concern. And if the court, you know, sees fit to address it in that way, I think that's why those courts have adopted those tacking and tolling approaches. If you get to a situation where, for example, the state waits to day 170 and dismisses, and then a year later comes back and reindicts, I think from a theoretical viewpoint or from a viewpoint of analysis of the case, there's no difference between waiting 170 days and waiting 14 days. The difference is that if we reindict, do we have 166 days left or do we have 1 day left? And the effect is going to be a dismissal if we had 1 day, if we waited till 179 days anyway. But the implications of using all the time period during which there are no charges pending, and I would just add in this case, to Mr. Van Norman said, were there restrictions on him during the time when no charges were pending? No. The case was over. The Supreme Court cases that address the similar Sixth Amendment issue have good language and that talk about that and how a person who is under investigation, even if they know they're under investigation, they essentially say, They don't suffer those same legal restrictions as somebody who has been charged with an offense. Mr. Andrews, in this case, was not in jail. In fact, he never served any jail time. He was given a PR bond on both indictments. He walked in, bonded right out. He never served a single day in jail. During the August 29th hearing, or access to the record, I guess it wasn't really a hearing, there was some general discussion about the real estate and his real estate license and the implications of that, and I don't recall all the details of that particular hearing, but it was brought up. And as Mr. Van Norman said, he asked about our position on that. And we made it very clear that simply wasn't an issue for us. We made it clear on the record that we were in no way involved in anything the Real Estate Commission might be doing. That was totally their ball to run. We had no input into that whatsoever. So the restrictions on him were not such as a person who's been charged with an offense.
But it's kind of a stretch of the language to say that the case was over, even though originally he had a public a personal recognizance bond, when everybody in the world knew that the case is going to be tried after the other case, right? So the case really isn't over. It's maybe delayed or maybe postponed or maybe held in abeyance or whatever. But it's not over in the sense that, like when the fat lady sings or anything like that. And What kept you from going in and making a motion to the court for good cause delay and say, Judge, it's important to us. We want to try this person after Sonnenschein gets tried, and we're asking for a period of time of good cause delay based on that good cause. Yeah. What keeps you from doing that?
As to address both your questions, first of all, no, I mean, it's obviously not over in the sense of hearing the fat lady sing, but it is over as far as that charging document is concerned. Is there an investigation still going, and what's going to happen in the future? Quite frankly, I think that remains to be seen at that, if we look at it from that August 21st point. Had we gone ahead and tried Mr. Sonnenschein first, and had Mr. Sonnenschein been found not guilty of accepting bribes, would that have affected how we prosecute the person who we allege to be paying the bribes? Very possibly. So I think there's circumstances that we can't necessarily know. I mean, obviously the investigation is ongoing, and obviously it was our intent to continue with the prosecution and to recharge at some point. I don't deny that, assuming everything works out as we would hope it work out.
Okay, maybe so, we can agree the indictment was over.
Yes.
The case certainly wasn't.
No, the investigation was certainly ongoing.
All right, how about the second point?
As to the second point, I don't know that we couldn't have gone in and done that and asked for a good cause delay. I think that the answer is that under the dismissal statutes, both in his brief and I think in some of the comments Mr. Van Norman made today, what he's attempting to do is put conditions on our ability to dismiss a case, saying that we didn't go in and say, here's our reason, and explain our reasons for doing that to the court. That's not required by statute. We can go in, the statute simply says we can file a dismissal, and the dismissal terminates the action. There is no statutory authority or no case law authority that I'm aware of in this state that puts those kind of conditions. I think the bottom line answer is that there wasn't good cause asked for. There wasn't reasons assigned to dismissing the case because they're not required. It is our prerogative in that case to dismiss should we see fit to do so. I don't disagree with your earlier comments that there may be consequences down the line to doing that in certain circumstances, but it's our position that under the speedy trial rules, under the 180-day rules, and under the statutes preceding that in the code, the dismissal statutes, that this is not a consequence of it, to hold that the speedy trial rules continue to run once we have dismissed a case. That's not one of the consequences. I can just 20 seconds, Stephanie, just briefly, Justice Zinter's comment about the Fisher case. In that case, I think it's very appropriate to what we're saying here. In that case, on a similar statute, they said that the statute says there's no bar to prosecution. If you start imposing these kind of time restrictions on it, it raises at least a partial bar, if not a complete bar, and I think that violates the spirit of the dismissal statutes, and the statute says there is no bar to prosecution.
Your time has expired, Mr. Love. Thank you.
Thank you.
The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.